Hi, my name is Sejal Parekh, and I'm your host today. Welcome back to our podcast, Precision Bites, Talking with Patients About Weight Management, a podcast of simulated clinic encounters dealing with motivational interviewing and weight management in different social contexts. Today, the provider will be talking with Mr. Brown, a 40-year-old male presenting to his primary care provider for a follow-up appointment after a recent hospitalization. Mr. Brown was diagnosed with biliary colic in the hospital. A cholecystectomy was not performed because his pain subsided quickly. Mr. Brown's BMI has been very slowly rising over the last 5 years, and today it's 34. He works full-time, has a stable family life, and describes himself as middle class. The medical assistant who hands you the chart mentions how nervous Mr. Brown is. Things we want you to take away from this encounter include 1. How to develop the patient's awareness of the discrepancies between his or her perception and health outcomes. And 2, how to ask advanced diet history questions. Hope you enjoy. Part 1, Fear and Confusion.
Come in.
Hi, Mr. Brown, how are you?
Doc, did you know I was in the hospital last week? Oh, it was terrible.
I'm sorry to hear that. The doctors who were taking care of you did give me a call. They told me what happened, but I really want to hear it from you. Can you tell me about it? How did you end up there?
I was just in so much pain. I didn't know what to do. It was over the weekend, and I knew your office was closed. I was just so worried. I didn't know what we were doing or...
I think you did the right thing by going to the ER. I'm glad you got it checked out. Sorry, Mr. Brown, I think I missed something. Where was the pain? When did it start?
Doc, it hurt really bad right here, like in my right upper belly. I've never felt anything like that before. It started Friday night, maybe after dinner. Well, maybe it wasn't after dinner. I don't know. What were we doing?
So the pain was in your right upper belly. What did it feel like? Sharp? Dull? Burning?
I would say it was pretty dull.
Okay.
And steady. Nothing I did made it better. For like 6 hours straight, it was pretty bad.
Okay, and any other symptoms? Any nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea?
Yeah, I guess I was nauseous. I think it was the pain making me nauseous, but I didn't throw up and no diarrhea. But I wasn't eating or drinking anything, so maybe that was why? I don't really know.
When did you first feel like not eating?
Well, probably an hour before the pain started. We were sitting down to have dinner, and I didn't really feel like eating much. My wife made a joke about me going on a diet or something like that.
Okay, and were you having any other symptoms at the beginning? Any shortness of breath or chest pain?
No. Well, maybe some shortness of breath from the pain, but I think that pain was the main reason.
Okay. So then you went to the ER, and you were admitted.
Yep. Oh, the ER was the worst. It just took so long for anything to happen. And the nurse there was rude, and the guy sitting next to me was just... They probably shouldn't call it the emergency room.
And then you were admitted, and what test did they do?
Well, they did an ultrasound. But then, Doc, I got pretty freaked out because the surgeons came to see me. They were saying how they might have to operate. But something about body habitus and tissue mass, I didn't really get where they were going with that. I've never had surgery, so I was nervous.
Oh, okay. Did the surgeons say why they wanted to operate?
Yeah. They were saying things about masses and concern for compression. To be honest, everything they said just sounded scary. And then they did a CAT scan. And then after that, they didn't want to operate. But I don't know, maybe they're right?
Right about what?
What if I got this because something is wrong?
Can you tell me what you're worried about?
I don't know. What if this is something like cancer?
Well, I'm really reassured that the pain went away. Your doctors in the hospital were saying that the pain was really bad for an hour or two and then got better. Do you have any history of gallbladder issues in your family?
No, I don't think so, but I'm not sure. Maybe I should call them today to figure it out, but I'm just so worried.
Okay, Mr. Brown, I don't want this to weigh on you. So here's what we'll do. We'll do a full review and physical exam today to make sure that everything's okay. But I do want you to know that For one, gallstones are unfortunately common, one of the most common digestive issues that Americans have. Hmm. And two, there are certain risk factors for gallstones, including age, weight, and diet. Hmm. The problem you had at the hospital was that we think a gallstone temporarily got stuck in the gallbladder outlet, which is called biliary colic.
Huh. Well, can't that just happen again?
To be honest, yes, it can. The most permanent way to stop that from happening is to take out your gallbladder surgically. And if this happens again, the surgeons will think about doing that. But in the meantime, there are changes I think we can do to decrease your risk for getting this again.
Well, I can't change my age.
Yes, but you can change your other risk factors like weight and diet. We know that with increasing BMI, the risk of getting symptomatic gallstones also increases. We just want to make sure that we do everything we can to make sure that you don't go back with the same pain.
Yeah, but Doc, my weight is fine.
Well, actually, your BMI, that's comparing your weight for your specific height, is 34.
Mm-hmm.
Normal BMI is from 18 to 25. Your two categories above normal BMI, or normal weight for your height.
Yeah, but I don't think it's my weight. I mean, I've been at the same weight, and I felt fine for years before I was at the hospital. Doc, there's got to be something else wrong.
Okay, we'll come back to the weight. I just want to make sure we reduce all of your risk factors for getting this again.
Sure. I just think it's something else.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a list of questions to see if there might be anything else that points to a less common cause of gallstones, okay?
Sounds great. Let's focus on that.
Okay, so you said you don't think you have any family history of gallbladder disease?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure.
Anyone with any type of liver disease?
My uncle was an alcoholic, so his liver failed pretty early.
How old was he when that happened?
In his early 60s.
Okay. Now let's talk about symptoms before the hospitalization. Any rapid weight loss recently?
Nope. Just been about the same for a while.
Any recent fatigue? Any fevers or night sweats?
No, I don't think so. I run a little warm when I sleep, but that's about it.
Anyone tell you that you look yellow?
What? No.
Any pain like this before?
Nope. That's why I'm worried about it.
Okay. And you said no chest pain, mild shortness of breath, most likely due to the pain.
Yep.
Okay. Any heartburn or stomach pain?
No. I think I had heartburn when I was younger, but nothing recently.
Okay. When was the last time you felt the heartburn feeling?
Oh, probably 10 years ago.
All right. Any change in your stool or urine color?
What? Oh, what does that mean?
Has your poop been light to dark brown, and has your pee been shades of yellow?
Yeah. What else would it be?
Well, sometimes with liver disease and gallbladder disease, your stool can turn silvery, and your urine can get darker. So sometimes if there's another problem, you can have blood in your stool.
Wow. Okay. No, I don't think so.
Okay. Everything looks good there. Now I'm going to ask you some questions about your past medical history. Have you ever had hepatitis?
No, I don't think so.
Ever had a stomach ulcer?
Nope.
Any history of kidney problems?
No, not that I know of.
High cholesterol?
No, I don't think so. You would have told me if I had that, right?
Yes, we would have called you about that. I just meant before you came to see me. Any medications you're taking?
Some vitamins sometimes when my wife really nags me, but not really. Oh, actually, I take allergy medication in the springtime.
Okay, those are fine. No antibiotics or other prescription medications?
Nope.
Okay. So, Mr. Brown, everything else sounds normal, and that's a great thing. Now, I know it doesn't feel like the weight is the reason, but could we go through a basic diet and exercise history just in case?
I guess. I just don't really see the point.
Well, we know that many patients get this type of pain after certain types of meals. Mm. I know that the hospitalization was scary, and I just want to make sure we have a comprehensive plan to make sure you don't get this pain again.
Okay, fine. I mean, I eat pretty healthy, so I don't know how much it will help.
Pearl 1, Fear and Confusion. Let's talk about why Mr. Brown came into the clinic for a post-hospitalization follow-up. In light of hospital readmission rates close to 20%, the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, introduced the Hospital Readmission Reduction Program. Under this program, Medicare has enforced penalties on hospitals for readmissions. These penalties are projected to be more than $500 million in the 2017 fiscal year, and these policies are starting to have the intended effect. Rehospitalization rates for Medicare beneficiaries started to fall in 2012 and have been trending downwards ever since. Much research has been conducted on how to avoid hospital readmissions. One meta-analysis, published in 2017, reviewed 13 articles and 106 hospitals that studied health information exchange and the impact on hospital readmission. This meta-analysis found that hospitals attempt to engage in health information exchange through a variety of ways, including telemonitoring, medication reconciliation, and coordinating follow-up appointments. However, in the specific case of cholelithiasis evaluated in the ED, one study found that only 25% of patients followed up with a surgeon to talk about elective cholecystectomy within 2 years of the ED visit. The post-hospitalization outpatient follow-up is an essential handoff. This is a time where the provider can use the patient's motivations to really cement a plan. The encounter with Mr. Brown highlights this. Due to the recent hospitalization, Mr. Brown is extremely motivated to avoid rehospitalizations. By positioning weight management as a way to avoid rehospitalizations, the provider can help Mr. Brown progress from the pre-contemplative state about weight loss. However, the actuality of doing this is hard. Hospitalizations can be scary, and it's understandable why patients would want advice that's more immediate than lose weight and follow up in 6 months. In this circumstance, you can reassure the patients by doing the free workup, or a history and physical, to ease their fears and gain their trust. Even if a complete physical exam is normal, it can help build rapport with the patient. One study evaluated all physical exams completed by emergency medicine residents for non-acute complaints in one hospital over 1 month. Of the 591 exams performed, only 8 were abnormal. When asked about their motivation to perform the physical exam in light of this yield, residents most commonly cited that they were screening underserved emergency room populations, establishing rapport with a patient, and performing the standard of care. While many studies, potentially including the one I just cited, underestimate the clinical utility of the physical exam, there are a variety of reasons to perform the exam. Throughout the history of medicine, the physical exam has been portrayed as a ritual in which the patient gifts the provider with authority and the provider applies his or her full attention to the patient. So, I waxed poetic for a bit there, but the point is simple. Do the history and physical. Even if it's normal, you establish rapport with the patient. In this encounter, the provider used this rapport to address the disconnect between the provider and Mr. Brown's perception of Mr. Brown's weight. It is critical to address this disconnect, because when the patient knows that he or she and the provider see the problem differently, the patient is less likely to make changes. Part 2. Unfruitful diet history.
Okay, so now I'm going to ask you a diet history. Let's start at the beginning. What do you usually eat for breakfast?
Fruit, granola, all healthy stuff. I guess once in a while my wife will make bacon for breakfast, but that's pretty rare.
How often do you think you have bacon?
Oh, probably once a month or something like that. Pretty rarely.
Okay. And when you say fruit, what kind of fruit is it usually?
Like an apple or something. Just fresh fruit.
Sure. Sounds great. And about how much granola are you having?
Oh, just a little bit.
Like one handful or two? What do you think?
No, not that much. Probably more like half a handful.
Okay. And do you think you drink anything with breakfast? Juice or coffee? Anything like that?
Well, usually a cup of orange juice with breakfast.
One cup?
Yep.
Okay. And then what do you have for lunch?
Well, usually a whole wheat sandwich with deli meat and vegetables and a piece of fruit, plus a soda for taste.
Okay, do you usually take the sandwich from home or from work?
Oh, I buy it at work, but it's pretty healthy.
And what kind of soda, regular or diet?
Oh, always diet.
Okay, and what about dinner?
Meat, vegetables, usually potatoes or rice or something. Maybe take out pizza once a week because the kids like it. But yeah, like I said, pretty healthy. We go out to eat sometimes, but we always order pretty healthy, too.
Okay. And anything to drink with dinner? Soda or wine?
No. Usually no soda with dinner. My wife doesn't like soda in the house because of the kids.
Any alcohol?
No. Not with dinner. Maybe a beer on Sunday with the game, but that's about it.
One beer, you said?
Yeah. Usually one or two, but not more than two. And I only drink on the weekends.
Okay. And back to dinner, sorry. How often do you eat out?
Probably once every 2 weeks. Something like that.
Okay. Mr. Brown, do you snack during the day?
Yeah. Usually around 2 or 3 p.m. I just like taking a break around that time of day.
What do you usually have for a snack then?
Well, I usually have something from the break room. Sometimes nuts or a healthy snack like fruit. Sometimes chips or a cookie.
How often would you say it's nuts and fruits versus chips and a cookie?
Most days it's nuts and fruits. I would say maybe like once a week it's a bag of chips.
Okay. And what about drinks? Any juice or soda at work?
Sometimes a diet soda or coffee at my break. Really depends on how tired I am.
Yeah, sure, that makes sense. Anything in your coffee, cream, or sugar?
No, not really. Everything's pretty healthy.
What about desserts?
Well, I do have a sweet tooth, but I would say we only have desserts maybe every other day.
All right, what do you usually have for dessert?
Ice cream. Occasionally my wife will make a cake or cupcakes for my kid's birthday, and we'll have some leftovers, but that's really it.
How much ice cream do you think you usually have?
Just a scoop. I really try to keep it in control.
Okay, sounds good. So let me just recap everything that you just said so I know we're on the same page. For breakfast, you usually have fruit, granola, and orange juice, bacon maybe once a month. No mid-morning snacks. For lunch, usually deli sandwich and fruit and diet soda. Mid-afternoon snack is usually fruits and nuts, but can be chips or a cookie. Maybe soda or coffee in the afternoon if you need the caffeine. Then dinner is vegetables, meat, and potatoes or rice, pizza maybe once a week, and occasionally eating out. And a scoop of ice cream after that. 1 to 2 beers on the weekend. Does that all sound right?
Yep. All pretty healthy, right? See? I told you, Doc.
Yeah. And what physical activity do you get?
Well, I walk in the house. I don't know, but I feel like I'm always walking.
Do you take walks outside?
No, not too many.
Do you have one form of exercise that you go for, like 20-minute chunk or something?
No, not really.
Pearl 2, Unfruitful Diet History. Well, that was interesting. Have you had that experience? Where there's a clear disconnect between what the patient's telling you and the clinical picture you see in front of you. The first step to addressing this disconnect is to be open-minded. Patients read physicians' nonverbal communication well, so patients will get defensive if they feel like the provider doesn't believe them. This is especially important in the context of weight management. Choose your words carefully. When speaking about weight, generally stick to words like unhealthy weight and unhealthy BMI. Avoid words like fat, fatness, and morbid obesity. When taking the diet history, the chronological approach is a good way to start. Begin with breakfast and proceed throughout the day. Remember to ask about drinks and snacks. This is often low-hanging fruit when it comes to making a plan. Asking about snacks can help you assess how frequently patients are eating. Frequency of eating can be tied to emotional cues, such as boredom, loneliness, or stress. Asking about drinks and desserts can help you evaluate hidden calories that patients may not even consider as part of their meal. For example, by cutting down one can of non-diet soda a day, patients can avoid gaining 1 pound a month. Some fruit juices can have just as much sugar as soda. One classic rule from Citibun is 880 calories, between 1/2 to 1/3 of your patient's daily caloric needs. It's important to ask patients about drinks and snacks. These calories are often forgotten in the patient's and provider's calculations. But what do you do when all these questions get you nowhere? We recommend asking the following questions to understand your patient's food consumption patterns. Ask about your patient's favorite meal. This can give you insight into the patient's palate profile. Asking about a favorite meal also removes much of the guilt that patients can feel when talking about their day-to-day diet. It's implied that the patient doesn't eat their favorite meal every day. Questions like these can also build rapport, as a favorite meal is a personal and positive memory. Next, ask about traditions around food. Many patients coming from communal cultures can struggle with dieting or calorie counting due to rituals and traditions involving food. These events can range anywhere from quinceañeras to blessed food given at the church to weekly barbecues with the cousins. It's important to be sensitive and thoughtful about these traditions when creating a plan. Finally, assessing portion size and access to food can also be revealing about a patient's caloric intake. We'll talk about it more in the next pearl. Part 3, further investigation.
Okay, Mr. Brown, most of your food choices are pretty healthy. I'm writing it all down now. So when I take a diet history, I usually like to ask my patients about food traditions and their favorite foods. It just helps me get a bigger picture. So tell me, do you and your family have any food traditions?
What? Sorry, I don't follow.
Are there certain foods you eat with your family while doing certain activities? For example, popcorn during movies, chips or snacks during game night, something like that. Do you get what I mean?
Yeah. So my wife and I usually watch TV after dinner. Mm-hmm. It's the only way we get time to sit together, you know? Otherwise, it's just work, kids, work, sleep. So we usually snack on chips or something light after dinner.
Okay, and how much do you think you usually have then?
Maybe a couple handfuls each. Nothing that dramatic.
Do you usually pour the chips in a bowl or out of the bag or something else?
Usually just out of the bag.
Okay.
We already started the dishwasher at that point, so we don't want to dirty any more dishes.
Okay, and Mr. Brown, what's your favorite meal?
Growing up, my mom used to make lots of casseroles, so I like those. I guess my favorite would have to be macaroni and cheese with breadcrumbs. I used to add hot sauce to it, and they really added a kick to it, you know? Mm-hmm. It's delicious. You should really try it.
Yeah, it sounds great. And Mr. Brown, who usually grocery shops and cooks at home?
Well, my wife and I go grocery shopping on the weekends, and she usually prepares dinner. I mean, I help out, but mainly I do dishes.
Okay, and last questions, I promise.
Okay.
When you're sitting down to eat, what do you think about your portion sizes?
I usually try to eat one portion of chips and stuff like that. But I don't know about portion sizes for home-cooked meals. I mean, the home-cooked meals are pretty healthy anyways, so...
Yeah, home-cooked meals do tend to be healthier. Mm. So serving size is what the typical recommended amount you should eat of a certain food. Mm-hmm. The packaged foods will usually say the serving size on the nutrition label. But portion size is what we actually end up eating. So, for example, those packaged fruit juices, like Odwalla, are sold as 2 servings in each bottle. But I tend to forget and drink the whole bottle. Huh. That means that my portion size was double the serving size. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but I don't know what to say. I think I'm eating okay.
Okay. So, sorry, that was kind of vague. Let's start specific.
Okay.
With meat, how much do you usually have for dinner?
Usually 2 to 3 pieces of chicken.
Okay. So 1 serving of meat is about the size of a deck of cards. If that's one serving, how much meat are you eating?
Probably 2 decks of cards.
So 2 servings?
I guess.
Okay, and now the potatoes are grains you have at dinner. So 1 serving of baked potatoes, about the size of a fist. 1 serving of pasta is about half the size of a baseball. That one always gets me. Anyways, how much would you say you have of those things?
Okay, well, I definitely don't have more than a fist of potatoes, but pasta? Half a baseball, that's nothing.
Yeah, I like to think of it this way. Our food packs a bigger punch than we realize. It's so easy to eat extra calories just because we're so used to big portions.
Yeah, I guess so.
Okay, Mr. Brown. So now we've been talking about your diet for a while. And while it does seem that you eat pretty healthily, you were also just in the hospital with this biliary colic that is strongly associated with diet and weight. Do you think there's any room to make changes in your diet?
To be honest, I'm confused, Doc. I'm trying to follow along with what you're saying, but I just don't get it. I'm trying to do all the right things. I mean, fruit and granola at breakfast. I try to eat vegetables at dinner. And I don't eat Big Macs every day. You know, I just feel like I'm a lot healthier than other people I know. And I feel like you're saying that the belly pain is because of my diet, but I don't even see the problem in my diet. I don't know, Doc. I just don't really understand what's going on.
I know that this can be really frustrating. The good news is that many of the food choices that you're making are healthy, like picking fruits and vegetables to eat over other foods. That's great.
Yeah, exactly. I just think that I'm already making such an effort with that I don't just get what you're saying.
Some foods are tricky, though. Sometimes one regular soda a day can increase your weight by 1 pound a month. Even when you're thinking you're making healthy choices like granola, there are added oils and sugars that add up in terms of calories. Foods make it easier for us to eat more than we intend to, like chips or buttery popcorn. It's so easy to eat those mindlessly. All of these things pack a big calorie bump that adds up throughout the day, even when most of the food choices you make are healthy. We can use this as an opportunity to improve what you've already been working so hard to do. Let's find those extra calories and cut them out so that all of your hard work can really pay off.
I just want to be able to eat something. I'm already thinking about what's good and bad.
Okay, so you feel like you're already spending a lot of energy on eating better, and you don't know how spending more energy will change things?
Yeah, or rather, yeah. I just don't know what else I could do. I think I'm doing a good job.
Yeah, you absolutely are. You're doing a great job, especially in picking the types of foods to eat for your meals. I know this feels overwhelming right now.
Yeah, it does. And I didn't come here for diet advice. I came because I was hospitalized, and I want you to help me not get hospitalized again.
Pearl 3, Further Investigation. In this part of the encounter, the provider asks Mr. Brown the advanced diet history questions we discussed in Pearl 2. One of the key advanced diet history questions is about portion size. To understand portion size, one must also understand serving size. A portion is how much a patient chooses to eat. On the other hand, a serving is a measured unit of food and its nutrients, for example, one slice of whole wheat bread. The goal of asking about portion size is to estimate the number of servings and therefore calories and nutrients that the patient is consuming. As the food pyramid has undergone changes over the years, so has serving size terminology. The 1990 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, published by the United States Department of Agriculture and the United States Department of Health and Human Services, do not mention servings or portion size. But these guidelines do encourage people to eat in moderation. The 1995 dietary guidelines do reference servings and portions frequently and include extensive tables to translate foods into servings. For example, it states that 1/3 cup of nuts is 1 serving of protein. The 2000 dietary guidelines include a more robust discussion about portion size and list choosing sensible portion sizes as a central strategy for weight loss. The following reports, in 2005 and 2010, continue to list limiting portion size as key components to weight loss. In 2013, the NIH National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute published a serving size card that translated serving sizes into everyday objects. For example, the size of a serving of meat is equivalent to a deck of cards. In this encounter, the provider uses the 2013 NIH serving size comparisons, such as half a baseball measurement for 1 serving of pasta. However, this card also compares serving sizes to objects that will become outdated, such as CDs. Thus, a new trend of estimating serving size is comparing it to a patient's hand. One study conducted at the University of Sydney compared 67 participants' accuracy in determining portion size based on the finger-width method of calculating serving size. This study found that 80% of participants estimated portion sizes within the margin of 25% when using the finger-width method. In comparison, Only 29% of participants estimated the portion size within a margin of 25% when using common kitchen measurements such as ounces. While the finger width method may not be the best for your patients, there are several other hand measurement systems out there. One easy-to-use method is outlined in the serving size comparison chart published by the Dairy Council of California in 2012. Finally, we want to make a note about motivational interviewing techniques. One common acronym used for motivational interviewing is OARS, which stands for open-ended questions, affirmations, reflections, and summarizing. While these steps can be time-consuming, they can help the patient feel like you are on the same side when talking about sensitive topics such as weight. If you don't have time to engage in all ORs, practice just asking open-ended questions or stating affirmations during the encounter. In this encounter, the provider asked, "Do you think there's any room to make changes in your diet?" This is not open-ended, as it generates a yes or no answer. The provider should have asked, "What are some changes you think you can make?" The provider also affirmed the patient with statements like, "You're picking fruits and vegetables to eat over other foods. That's great." These statements can go a long way in building rapport with your patient. Pearl 4, behavior changes.
"Okay, Mr. Brown, I know you're here because you were just in the hospital. Remember when I said that biliary colic can be brought on by certain types of meals? Mm-hmm. Well, they're usually brought on because of meals with high fat content. That's why I wanted to get a sense of your diet to see if there was a specific trigger. You're right in pointing out that you eat nutritious meals. You choose to eat fruits and vegetables. That's why I started asking about portion size to see if that could explain why the biliary colic happened."
"And what?"
"Well, I do think things in your diet would exacerbate biliary colic."
"Doc, we just went over this. I thought you agreed that I eat well."
"I do think you make a significant effort to make good choices, but I just want to let you know that there are simple changes you could make to be even healthier. They don't take that much effort. They could really let your hard work show and could really help avoid getting the biliary colic again."
"I'm confused. Do you think I'm eating healthy or don't you? I feel like you're saying both."
"Mr. Brown, I think you're doing a great job so far, but I think there are simple changes to be even healthier. With your BMI and recent hospitalizations, I think there is room for improvement."
"Okay, so you don't think I eat well now?"
"No, that's not what I'm saying at all." "Weight is a balance of food people take in and exercise that burns that food. If a patient is making all the right food choices and still gaining weight, it could be due to portion size or how much of the healthy food the patient is eating. For example, if my patient were eating rice cakes, one or two slices could be fine, whereas 12 slices is probably too much. That's an extreme example, but I was just trying to make a point."
"I don't really get where you're going, Doc."
"Okay. Let me just give you an example so this isn't as vague. For example, I think if you measured one serving of chips and put that in a bowl to eat over TV, that would be better than eating out of the bag. That's a simple change, and it's not like you have to give up chips, but just have them in moderation."
"Okay, so now I have to eat less?"
"Of certain foods, chips, meats, desserts, things like that. Foods with lots of sugar and fat. Mm. Other foods you can have plenty of, like fresh vegetables. Having more vegetables could also help you feel fuller." "Look, Mr. Brown, I'm not saying you have to cut all the chips and desserts out, just in smaller doses. Can I give you a couple examples of things you could do?"
"Fine."
"So this is advice I'd like to give all of my patients. One, buy smaller plates and bowls. Our stomach can rely on our eyes for fullness signals. So if you eat one cookie off a big plate, it won't feel like you ate much. If you ate a cookie off a small dessert plate or saucer, it will feel like you ate more. So the big thing to look for is smaller plates and bowls. I like to recommend plates less than 9 inches across and bowls less than 6 inches."
"I mean, that sounds expensive."
"You know, it's actually not. I go to Walmart every couple of months, and when I was there last week, I saw this really great dining set for 4 people, 12 pieces total for $10. Mm. Isn't that crazy?" "And the plates and bowls were smaller than the average set."
I guess that's not too bad. but I still don't know if I need to do that.
Okay. Well, can I give you another example of a small change I tell my other patients to make?
Fine.
So, second, I also tell my patients to only eat out of plates and bowls, not out of bags or containers. The reason I say that is that many people are used to eating until the food is done. If you eat out of a bowl, you're more likely to stop eating when the bowl is empty. If you eat out of a bag, you're more likely to keep eating, so it's easier to eat larger portions than you mean to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe. What else?
Well, the third thing I'd like to recommend is to buy a measuring cup. They can also be pretty cheap at places like Walmart. Since servings are a lot smaller than we usually recognize, it can be helpful to have a measuring cup around to get a sense of how much one cup or half a cup really is.
Yeah, okay.
For example, you could use it to measure your ice cream before you eat.
I mean, sure. Anything else?
Yeah. The last thing I like to recommend is to incorporate physical activity in your daily routine. So, for example, twice a week, instead of watching TV with your wife, maybe the two of you could go for a walk. Or the whole family could go if the kids are done with their homework. Mm. It can be a nice way to bond.
Yeah, sure. But I heard somewhere that you have to exercise, like, for a full hour every day to lose weight. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. This amount of exercise won't help you lose excess weight, but it will help you stop from gaining weight. Plus, I don't know about you, but 1 hour every day can seem intimidating to add. I usually like to recommend starting at this level and then increasing the duration and frequency of the workout as you go.
Okay.
So, Mr. Brown, I wanted to give you some examples because I don't want this to seem overwhelming. Out of these four changes I suggested, are there any that you think you want to make? Or do you have any other diet things that you would like to change?
I mean, I guess I could suggest to my wife that we go for a walk twice a week instead of TV. Maybe she would go for that. And I could pour out the chips into a bowl before we eat them. That sounds reasonable.
Great. I'm glad that those changes seem reasonable. Any other changes you think would be a good idea?
Well, maybe I should cut down on the soda. I mean, I usually have diet soda, but still, maybe that would be better.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I forgot to bring that up earlier, the soda and juice. Since you're drinking diet soda, it's not a big deal in terms of calories, but orange juice, even if it is all natural and everything, still has a lot of sugar in it. That can quickly add up in calories.
Doc, I want to keep the orange juice. Can't I just exercise more or something?
Sure, and I'm glad you told me that you wanted to keep it. So, the average cup of orange juice has about 100 calories. If you were to walk at an average pace, about 3 miles an hour, you'd have to walk about 30 extra minutes to work off the orange juice.
Oh. I guess I'll think about it then. One cup of orange juice is 30 minutes of walking?
Yeah, some foods are deceptive. They have a lot more calories than we expect.
Wow.
And Mr. Brown, do you see why these changes are important?
Yeah, because you think my diet caused the biliary colic.
Yeah, we know that a patient's diet can really exacerbate their biliary colic. And do you think these changes are possible?
Yeah. I do think those three are possible.
Okay, great.
Pearl 4, behavior changes. In this part of the encounter, the provider tries to navigate affirming the patient while still encouraging him to change. Negotiating with the patient is tricky, so it's important to have built rapport before this part. For patients who are still in the pre-contemplative state and can't necessarily see their role in the health issue, it's important to be strategic about the changes you recommend. Try not to suggest changing your patient's favorite foods or food traditions. There are usually many other places to make calorie cuts or increase caloric expenditure. One of these high-yield places is portion size. Satiety is in part psychological and has more to do with mass and volume of food than necessarily caloric intake. Eating off of a smaller plate can make food appear larger and increase patient satiety even after eating less. Moreover, patients are usually more amenable to negotiating portion size as opposed to cutting foods out entirely. This is why the provider recommended pouring chips into a bowl before eating them, as opposed to not eating them at all. This is also why the provider recommended buying a measuring cup to measure snacks and desserts. So those were some content tips for the pre-contemplative patient. We also want to bring up some communication style tips with these patients. When engaging in motivational interviewing, it's important to bring up preparatory change talk. Preparatory change talk highlights the following categories: desire, ability, reason, and need. Desire corresponds to statements such as, I want to change. Ability is emphasized in statements such as, I can change, and I have the tools necessary for change. Reason is underlined in statements such as, it's important to change. And finally, need is underscored in statements such as, I should change. Even rephrasing the patient's statements into these categories can be empowering and frame change as something that's possible for patients. In this encounter, the provider engaged in preparatory change talk by asking Mr. Brown about ability or which changes would be easiest to implement. The provider also discussed the hospitalization as a reason to change. Part 5, Closing.
All right, so just so we're both on the same page, could you tell me the changes we're making after today?
One, don't eat straight from the bag, carton, or container. Transfer the amount you want from the container to a bowl and eat only out of plates and bowls. Two, go for walks twice a week instead of TV. And three, cut down on the soda. Oh, if I have orange juice, I have to walk an extra 30 minutes.
Okay, sounds great. And I find that patients usually do best if they have measurable goals. So, for example, with soda, how much would you like to cut back by?
Well, I have about a soda a day, so maybe I could cut back by 2 a week.
Sounds good. So down to 5 sodas a week. Okay, great. Mr. Brown, I would like to see you in a month to check in about the biliary colic and to do a weight check and see how these changes are going. Does that work for you?
Sure, I guess.
Okay, great. So that's all for us today. Do you have any questions for me?
Yeah. What should I do if I get that pain again?
That's a great question. First thing is time it. If it doesn't go away in 1 to 2 hours, I would call my office or urgent care if we're closed. Mm. If the pain is from your gallbladder, it should feel like dull pain in your right upper belly, just like you felt it before. Mm. It's okay if it radiates to your back or right shoulder. The pain should not feel like an elephant sitting on your chest. The pain should not be worse with movement either. Mm. If you feel those things that I just mentioned, then it could be your heart, and you should definitely see a doctor immediately.
Okay.
If you feel gallbladder pain the way I described it, the second thing to do would be to take some medication for pain, like Tylenol. Mm. But you should be seen if this happens again. And that's another reason I wanted to see you again in 1 month. If you have one more episode of this pain, I definitely recommend starting a medication to avoid this biliary colic. And thinking about taking out the gallbladder surgically, like we talked about before. It is a pill called ursodiol that you take twice a day. If you have 2 or more episodes of this pain in the upcoming month, I would recommend thinking very seriously about removing the gallbladder surgically.
Really? Is it that serious?
Well, the reasons we should think about surgery is because if you get an inflamed gallbladder, there can be complications from that that can make you pretty sick. We just want to avoid that. And the surgery is pretty safe for removing the gallbladder. They just make 3 or 4 small holes in your belly that seal up with only 1 or 2 stitches.
Okay, well, let's hope it doesn't get there.
Yeah, I think these changes will help. Okay, Mr. Brown, see you in a month?
Yep, sounds good. Thanks, Doc.
Pearl 5, Closing. In this part of the encounter, the provider asked Mr. Brown to repeat back the changes he's going to make and provided anticipatory guidance in case Mr. Brown's biliary colic returns. To be honest, Mr. Brown is likely still in the pre-contemplative state about his weight management. After this appointment, hopefully he's moving towards a contemplative state. But despite the provider's best efforts, patients in a pre-contemplative state often need lots of time and reinforcement to make significant changes. If Mr. Brown can afford and has the time for a comprehensive weight loss program, that would likely be his best bet for long-term weight management. In a comprehensive weight loss program, he could work with a psychologist and a health coach. These professionals could offer consistent counseling.
Weight management counseling for pre-contemplative patients is best in over time, and the maintenance counseling typically does not need to be done by a physician. In terms of the anticipatory guidance related to biliary colic, remember that 1/3 of patients with initial biliary colic will not develop recurrence in 2 years. However, a recent study of symptomatic cholelithiasis patients showed that delaying cholecystectomy can lead to multiple ED visits and higher rates of emergent cholecystectomies. While cholecystectomy can be indicated for patients with an isolated attack of biliary colic, this is a judgment call. If the patient wishes to avoid surgery, the provider can consider oral dissolution therapy such as ursodiol. This is a reasonable option as long as the provider offers clear counseling of what to do in case the pain comes back and what the risks are of keeping the gallbladder in. We want to make a correction to the script. The provider recommended that Mr. Brown take Tylenol for pain management if the biliary colic returns. We recommend Advil or another NSAID. I hope that felt realistic and was helpful for you. Let's recap some of the key points of this podcast. 1. Anger and frustration. The post-hospitalization follow-up is an essential handoff and a unique opportunity for the provider to talk about behavior change. Also, prioritize doing the physical exam. 2. Unfruitful diet history. Choose your words carefully when it comes to weight. If the traditional diet history doesn't give you helpful information, ask about the patient's favorite meal, food traditions, and portion sizes. 3. Further investigation. Explain the difference between portion size and serving size to your patient. Your patients can use the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute serving size card or the hand measurement method to estimate the serving size. Also, practice ORS for motivational interviewing. 4. Behavior change. Preparatory change talk highlights desire, ability, need, and reason. Reframe your patient's statements into these categories for increased efficacy. 5. Closing. Do the best you can, but know that pre-contemplative patients may require time to engage in behavior change. Thanks, and see you next time. This podcast was made possible by the support of the Area Health Education Centers, California, California Public Health Training Center, Western Region Public Health Training Center, and the Medical Scholars Fellowship by Stanford University School of Medicine. Thanks to Dr. Michelle Hauser for her feedback. Special thanks to Virginia Fax for her support and advice. Thanks to Leah Sling and James Seifert for their superb acting.
Do you have one form of exercise that you go for, like 20-minute chunk or something?
No, not really. Dun, dun, dun.